speaking to Sidney Pollack, whose film I called Sketches of Frank Gehry, which Sony Pictures Classics is bringing into theaters on May 19th in Los Angeles, anyway. And it's going to be also shown at the Cannes Film Festival, and which debuted, at least for me and many other journalists, at the Toronto Film Festival to pretty strong acclaim, as I remember. And thanks for being with me, Sidney, and talking about it.
My pleasure.
I guess I could start by just reminding everybody that I wrote a good while ago when I first saw it, which is that I've always felt, as you yourself admit, Sidney, you've never felt like you were much of a scholar as far as the work of Frank Gehry, who is one of our, who to me is the pretty much the Pablo Picasso of architects, and you kind of take a very folksy, I don't know that much tone in the beginning, which is what's so winning about your film, because it reaches out to the person who doesn't feel particularly sophisticated about architecture, and you translate it in a very simple and yet very engrossing way about what Frank has been about and what is and you know, the scope of his art, and that's what got me, is that you have a very inviting style that allows a person to really get into it in a nice, easy way.
So. Well, it was, I did that sort of by accident, because it was simply the truth. I mean, I truly don't know anything about architecture. I know a lot more now, having done the film. That was an education for me, but nor had I ever made a documentary, so both things were brand new experiences, and as I say in the film, when I said to Frank and tried to beg off of it, I said, Frank, you know, I'm not the guy to do this. I don't know, you know, architecture well. I'm not a scholar in architecture, and nor am I an experienced documentarian. His answer to me was, that's why you're perfect. I mean, he truly did not want somebody who was going to take a scholarly approach toward this thing. He wanted, I guess, the eyes of an innocent, or some sort of an innocent. He wanted it to come fresh in some way, and so after saying no several times, he finally talked me into it. That, and the fact that once I saw the museum in Bilbao, I was so blown away by it that I was fascinated myself to learn by what mysterious process does a building that beautiful and moving come into being.
Yeah.
I couldn't imagine when I saw it how anybody could think it up, let alone figure out how to build it. And that's really what pushed me over the top and made me say, okay, I got to try this, because I've got to learn myself.
Yeah.
So a lot of what was going on in the making of the film was not only some sort of an appreciation of his work as I saw it and then tried to find out how to photograph it to best present it to the viewer, so that it had the impact that it had on me as I saw it, but also to find out from Frank what the hell the process is, where does it start, and how does it journey through from the start to the end. When I first saw Bilbao, I thought, I kept saying to myself, this looks to me like a dream, like something I would dream in the middle of the night, you know,
yeah,
a dope or something. Mm-hmm. I kept thinking it looked like something built by Don Quixote stone, and I just couldn't imagine thinking it up. So I just went ahead, sort of innocently, bit by bit, and tried to ask the questions that were fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of turned out to be, in some ways, a good representation of an audience point of view about it.
I guess the reason that I earlier analogized him with Picasso, because I've always remembered that statement that he made at one time, in which he said that it took him many, many years, many decades, to achieve the sense of simplicity that a child has naturally. It took him a long time to get there. And I was very, very touched and amused, really, by watching Frank and his assistants and his colleagues at his studio basically playing around with scotch tape, cardboard, pieces of magazines, and it's extremely inviting to see a guy who's known to be, you know, the genius that he's regarded. That's where it starts, with something as simplistic as what you see your kid doing, really. And
he says in the film that when he was a kid, his grandmother used to bring in pieces of firewood, and the pieces that were left over, he would put on a they would put on the table, and he would play with them with his grandmother, these little building blocks and things. And he always had a feeling that this would be a wonderful thing, that if he could find a way to keep playing with these blocks in some way. So I think he had an inkling, even as a kid, that there was a playfulness and that it was attached to his childhood in some way.
Right.
This whole idea of architecture, how he stumbled into it in a way.
And I think anyone who's ever felt... anyone who's ever aspired to any kind of creative endeavor can really relate, and it's very inspiring to hear the story about how that Frank Gehry was not always the Frank Gehry that we know. He was at one time, a guy who was always very talented, but he didn't really cross over the Rubicon creatively until he was, are we talking about, was it the early 80s? When did he start really being daring and doing the stuff that is going to really,
Well, he was doing it right from the beginning, but he didn't begin to achieve any kind of name at all until the late 80s, really. Mid-80s to late 80s, but he was doing certain... His house created an enormous kind of a stir, but it wasn't all favorable at all. The house that he built for me and Berta, his wife, kids, was a very controversial building. A lot of people hated the radical approach that it had, because it was so it exposed all of these building raw materials. It was sort of always famous for chain link fence and showing the beams. And a lot of people didn't like it. They thought it was ugly and depressing. But there were fans that started, and they were adamant about it, and then he just kind of rose on. But it was the Bilbao Museum really that put him into the sort of stratosphere of fame that he's in now. I mean, it was extraordinary what happened. When that thing hit, it was like a publicity revolution and a cultural revolution, and it made Bilbao, which was a depressed industrial town, rather ugly, turned it into a destination city. There are 350,000 inhabitants in that city, and the first year that the museum opened, they had 700,000 visitors. They had double the population of the city. The building paid for itself in just a little over a year.
Amazing.
And just in tourists. Travel. And that sort of put him into an orbit in a way as an architect. And then, of course, came the Disney Center and all of these other things, MIT that he's building, and now he's doing a line of jewelry for Tiffany that's extraordinary. I just looked at that, a lot of that yesterday. I was out at his offices looking at the jewelry, and it's amazing. It's just really amazing. So, like a lot of things, when you look at something like that, you wonder why it's never been done before. It's kind of the way you feel about Bilbao.
Some
of these places, you say, Jesus, it's always, why didn't anybody do this until now? And Frank always says, what keeps him humble in a way is he keeps imagining what would have happened if guys had a computer 2,000 years ago.
The reason I mentioned that he only got going later in life is I'm thinking of that moment in which he referred to his having designed a large structure in Santa Monica on the big indoor mall in Santa Monica.
Santa Monica Mall, yeah.
Yeah, and he alluded that was not, you know, that was more typical than not of, of some of the stuff he was doing, and he didn't feel all that delighted about it. He, you know, paid the bills, and he was glad to have the work, and he didn't think it was, but, you know, he was saying he didn't feel all that enthused, creatively enthused, anyway, about that kind of thing.
You know, the story he tells, honestly, is that the day was completed. He had the guy that owned the company that built it to dinner.
Oh.
And when that guy looked at his house, Frank's own house where he lived, he was sort of stunned. And he said, wait a minute. If you like this, he said, well, he said, you must like it. He said, if you like this, you can't possibly like that. And he pointed over toward the mall.
Yeah.
And Frank said, well, you're right, I don't. And the guy said, well, what the hell are you doing it for? And Frank said, well, I got to make a living. And the guy said, well, don't do that anymore. Just don't do that. You can't. That's not the way for an artist to behave.
Yeah.
And at that time, there were 140 people working on projects for that guy, future projects for that guy, in Frank's office. And they shook hands, and he quit doing those kind of commercial malls.
Mm.
And he says it was the happiest period in his life from then on. He ended a really creative period where he was doing the kind of work that he wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And he sort of he gives that particular guy credit, a lot of credit.
Right.
And I agree with him. That's a pretty gutsy thing for a guy to say.
Now, I was intrigued by what you mentioned about MIT. I think he might have mentioned that to me directly when I met him at that lovely party you guys gave at on Wellington Street. Is there some way for a person online to see what is going on at MIT that he has done, or some visualization when it is completed? Do you happen to know?
Jeffrey, I can find out.
Yeah.
I don't really know offhand, but I'm absolutely sure there is. Or maybe there's even a website of Frank Gehry's that you could go to. I don't really know, but I would try going to a Frank
Gehry's
website. Somebody must be.
Yeah, I was going to say that I would presume. By the way, does Sketches of Frank Gehry have its own site now? I didn't even check before we talked.
No, we don't have a site, but that's one of the things we're working on now. We will have a site. And you know, trying to figure out how to make some use of all of the other footage, because documentaries, unlike features, have a, you know, it's really the tip of the iceberg. The documentary itself is just a fraction of the footage that was shot. Since in making documentaries you don't really know the shape of the movie, you just keep on shooting. I must have, you know, 15, 20 hours of, or more maybe, of you know, a film on both Frank and the work that he's done. I'm sure when we get a website, we'll make use of some of that footage, because I hate it. There's a lot of it that's terrific that I think people that are fans of Frank's, or just fans of architecture in general, would be curious about and interested in, or just fans of the creative process.
I was going to say, in addition to whatever is offered on the website in terms of stills or additional footage, I would love to see all kinds of extras on the DVD. I hope that's being planned.
Well, that we'll try to do as much as possible. You know, there's a lot more of Milton, for example, his psychoanalyst, who I think is kind of the glue of the whole piece in a way, because Milton has been with him for 35 years and has sort of gone through all of these phases and kind of been his mentor in a way emotionally, like all good analysts are, and helped him through the various processes to get him to the point where he could tap all of that particular talent that he has and function more and more and more efficiently. I mean, he's working so well now. You know, I mean, he's putting out so much good work and so efficiently in terms of, I would guess that he would tell you what he was doing 30 years ago, which is before he, you know, somehow came to terms with certain parts of himself that Milton helped him with.
Yeah.
Milton somehow provides the rudder for this documentary.
Now, how did it feel to you, How were the creative differences for you, the filmmaker, Sydney? You obviously a master of a certain type of very well-made mainstream studio films that you've been doing since the well, since
Well, you know,
you know.
I one of the reasons that Frank and I got so close so fast was that he used to talk to me about his frustrations at feeling completely shackled and in a straitjacket because he worked in a field that was totally dictated by commercial demands. And I used to laugh and say, if you think you work in a field that's dictated by commercial demands, try, working for a film studio, a public company like that. And we used to talk about it all the time. He'd say, what do you do? And I would always say, within the demands of the constrictive demands of commercial filmmaking, I find a tiny bit of space where there's room for myself. And there is room. And he brings that up to me all the time. He actually brings it up to me in the film. And he said, I'll never forget the night you said that to me. It was at a party somewhere quite a while ago, actually, in the 80s. And so yeah, I do. I mean, he's got a lot of those demands. Although, you know, the position that he's in now, people aren't as interested in him for the art of his sculptural designs as constructions as they are anything else. Of course, he has to make them work. He's got to get sewer pipes and elevators, all of that in, but. You know, he has probably a greater degree of freedom now than he's ever had in his life.
Yeah. Well, did you feel more free in making a documentary and not really knowing where it was going to go or how it would be shaped? Was that as difficult, less, more fun than a studio film? How did you feel about making this?
Well, I
One.
made it as a hobby and because I love Frank. I mean, I didn't make it at all because I. You know, was doing it professionally in any way. I made it literally because I wanted very badly to do it as I promised Frank I would do it. It was really something that I promised Frank I would do. And so I kind of did it like that. So I didn't feel the pressure at all that I feel when I'm making a commercial film. And in many ways, that became a big help.
Well, it's awfully it just knowing you as I do. Not saying we're close pals, but I feel I know your personality. It was very nice to I could feel you all through this more vividly than I have felt you in, say, Out of Africa or The Firm or I mean,
Well, sure, because.
I could really feel your personality, your presence. It was nice, you know.
Well, partially because I was literally there and because it was a dialogue
Yeah.
between the two of us, but partially it was because I didn't have the pressure of making a $50 million or $100 million movie.
Yeah.
You know, that's a big part of what it
Right.
was.
Well, what I'm trying to say is that in addition to your directing of your features, the last of which was The Interpreter, the excellent Interpreter, and your various producing entities, which include Breaking and Entering, the Minghella film, and a thing called Leatherheads. No, is that still happening? Leatherheads?
No, well, we haven't. That's been a long time in the gestation period. Don't know whether we ever will make it or
Oh.
not, but that's something Soderbergh has always been interested in.
Okay. Well, I just would like to see you continue in this vein because I found it quite enjoyable and I just liked it a lot and I just hope that you continue to do these type of things in addition to all your other mainstream activities, which are speak for themselves.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Yeah.
I'm glad you liked it so much.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to seeing what will happen when the film
Yeah.
is released. Be interesting to see.
Now, out of curiosity, I didn't ask the publicist this, but it says it's going to open in Los Angeles on May 19th. That means a New York opening is some other time?
So
Which
it'll
one?
open at Tribeca Festival on the 3rd of May
Okay.
in Tribeca, and then it's playing the Cannes Festival on the 26th, but then it opens here, and you have the dates of that.
Yeah. All right, but I presume then it'll start to fan out in other cities right from May 19th,
so that's right.
A person in Chicago or Seattle listening to this can expect to see it sometime in maybe early June or something like that, right?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Very good.
Exactly.
Thank you very much for taking the time, Sydney.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
And I look forward to saying hello in Cannes.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye-bye.